Welcome to Destiny. Now here's your host, Cliff Dunning.
Well, there you go. Summer has arrived. The solstice happened, the longest day of the year. So, hey, I hope you're doing well, and welcome to Destiny. We are going to delve into the death experience, what happens when we die today, and we're going to look at it from an insider's point of view. Now, I've had, over the years, a number of the so-called experts on the near-death experience, the NDE experience, and actually had some of the top names in research. Dr. Raymond Moody, he wrote a book called Life After Life. That's now going on about 25 years. Dr. Michael Newton, who wrote Journey of the Souls, and even an experiencer of the near-death experience, that's Danion Brinkley, who wrote a book called Saved by the Light. These were conferences that I was the program director for. Conferences were called Whole Life. And they started in the late 90s, 1996, 7, and stopped at around 2001. That was what I was doing, developing those to big applause. But to that point, we hadn't really learned about the full aspect of the near-death experience, because the people who have these experiences go to a certain level and then are told that it's not their time to pass over yet. They are not ready to die. There's more work to be done. And they gain consciousness and they are awoken, or they are awakened in the hospital setting where they were pronounced dead. Now, today we're going to hear from a clinical psychologist who has done an excellent job of tracking just what happens when we leave our physical bodies and enter the spiritual realm, known as heaven, the etherics. There's a thousand different names for it, depending on what culture you're from. But what makes our program today unique is that we're going to hear about the process of death, the levels of learning that happen when we pass, and some of the highlights that we can experience when we pass over to the spiritual realm and drop our body. Now, I did mention Danion Brinkley. I know Danion quite well. He's a friend, actually. And he has been the spokesperson for, I'd say, at least a decade or more on what happens when we die, who we meet, the beings that are in that realm, what is expected of us, what we expect of ourselves, just so much that is brought out in the research that goes way, way back, but he experienced it firsthand. Now, Danion Brinkley was hit by lightning and was pronounced dead. He was dead for 20 minutes. In fact, they were taking him to the morgue. How horrible. When he rose, when he woken from his experience, and he was in shock and in intensive care, I think for a few weeks until he could regain full use of his body and his mind. But I thought it'd be important that we hear a little bit in an excerpt interview from Danion on just what his near-death experience was, and take that as the foundation of what we're going to hear about today. Now, today, Dr. Matthew McKay will talk about his work with his son, Jordan. His son was murdered at the age of 23, it so devastated him that he sought resources to reach out beyond the normal physical world and enter the spiritual world to communicate with his son. Now, we're going to hear direct information about what happens when we cross over. And Jordan told his dad that this book had to be written. In fact, Jordan is the basis of this new book called the luminous landscape of the afterlife, to help people who are afraid of death, who may be very ill and may not have a lot of time left on earth. Or for those people, this book would be great for people who have had loved ones pass over, who are curious, and what happens when we leave, or what they call shed the body. So, but to start as a prelude to this interview today, let's hear a little bit from Danyon Brinkley on what he experienced in the etheric field.
As we return to the other side, the only way we can acclimate ourselves to the true power of spirit is through this white, brilliant light. It is as though God is letting us know we're home safe. I'm looking around. This light is so brilliant, it becomes a part of me and I become a part of it, but I know I'm safe. As I watch this, all of a sudden, at a 45-degree angle from me, this being, B-E-I-N-G, for those who don't understand Southern, a being.
A person.
A being, a brilliant, beautiful being that put out rays of color.
Big, small?
Big. Well, you don't range the size. It was bigger than me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 6'4", 225 pounds, so I guess I'd be big. But as this being didn't have a face. I never looked at that. I was too immersed in the energy it was producing. And it was communicating with me almost in a telepathic sense. But when you think about a big auditorium, and in this auditorium, it's a hot day and you're inside and all the lights are out, and someone opens the door and steps into it, you see their silhouette and the light floods in around them, and that's what you see.
Mm-hmm.
As this being came close to me, I have had what I believe to be the single most important aspect of the near-death experience, other than it happens, panoramic life review. Everyone will have this. There was nothing unusual about me except that I got back here. But here's what will happen. You will start feeling all the childlike emotions. Then you will literally have a panoramic life review.
A movie?
No.
It's not a movie?
No, it's interactive. You are there again. You are experiencing your own birth, every interaction with every person that you've ever had, every event, every point, every perspective, every event, and you're watching it from a third person. Now, I've often tried to figure out a way for people to think this. The only way that I, in my simple way, can say it is that you're going to judge yourself and watch these events from this point. And I'm not real religious yet, but I'm spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
People say, did you get religion? Nope. Did you get spiritual a little bit? Well, what did you get? I got smart. You don't have to kill me but a couple of times and I'll figure it out. And so, you will look at yourself from this point. If God couldn't show up today, and God sent you in the events that you are about to watch, what difference did God make in the lives of the events that you're taking place? It's a heavy responsibility. But that's what we're doing here. God couldn't show up today. And you had to be the difference that God made in these situations of what you're about to see. What difference did God make? But not only that, I literally became every person that I have ever encountered. I got to feel the direct results of my interaction. I got to feel the pain, frustration, humiliation, anger, anxiety that I had inflicted on thousands of people, not just a few people. What a jerk. And I can promise you this, it wasn't a good day for God that day. Because if I was supposed to make a difference, I can understand why fear and hatred and animosity toward what we think of why me, God, why me. I can see how people feel like that if I was to represent it.
Now, it's funny. I spoke to Danyon about 4 weeks ago, and we were talking about a conference that he was going to join. He's going to be our guest here on Destiny in, I think, November. And his perspective is also quite unique. And I think what little we heard in this excerpt interview is helpful. It's a starting point, but we'll get the whole story from him when we have him on the program. So today, Dr. McKay's research and what he discovered is a major step forward, because we go into incarnation, death, and then coming back into another body, we see the whole process. And this is something that hasn't been discussed. It's been talked about in the Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Maya talk a little bit about it. I think even some of the Chinese early dynastic shaman have a sense of it too. And we hear read a little bit about it in their documents. But today is unique for so many reasons, and I think you're really gonna enjoy the interview. So that's our program today. Hey, we're also have a very important program in the Conversations on Cannabis segment. There are these cannabis vape pens that are killing people. And Dr. Hernandez is going to talk a little bit about why people are not paying attention to who is selling these concentrates. Concentrates are liquid cannabis, and they are extremely strong and extremely dangerous, and their use is continuing to grow as more states become legal. So you'll want to listen to the Conversations on Cannabis with Dr. Pepper, as always, because every week she brings the cutting edge on using cannabis, the body, mind, and spirit connections, and how to go about getting the best quality cannabis for your personal use. So looking forward to that. Again, happy summer, and I hope you enjoy the show. So this week we want to check in with Dr. Hernandez on a subject that's in the news, which is vaping pens or vape pens and the people who are dying. Apparently, what we're finding out is that there's certain mixes in these concentrates, these cannabis concentrates and e-pens that is deadly to individuals. It's poisonous to the lungs, poisonous to the human system. And we need to find out what this is all about. So, Pepper, what's going on with this? What's in the news here?
Hi, Cliff. Well, you know, I've been talking about this for years now of mm-hmm. how getting into, you know, putting extra additives or cutting agents into particular vape pens or cartridges, that was just going to give cannabis a really bad name. And so now we're starting to see it happen, that people are having, you know, major lung issues, respiratory issues, because of the chemicals that these companies are adding to the cannabis. Mm-hmm. So you think you're getting a vape cartridge that's CBD rich or CBD dominant, but really what's happening is, like what we talked about in the past, is the terpenes, which are most effective, and the cannabinoids, those are pretty much burnt off, mm-hmm. one. And two, they're adding these interesting cutting agents that we're finding out the FDA says are actually safe for human ingestion.
Okay.
But I feel like it's a combination of having the wrong cannabis with pesticides, you know, and not high quality anti-agents or cutting agents, okay. contaminants.
So what are people supposed to, how should they be looking at, we're talking about concentrates, which are heated, turned into smoke or vapor in the case of vape pens, and then inhaled. So what should people be looking for when they buy a concentrate so they can avoid this really deadly stuff?
Yeah, of course. Just getting the most pure thing they possibly can, like a live rosin or something that doesn't have a huge mix of different agents, and we can go over a couple of those just so people can be aware of, as well as making sure that the pesticide level in the cartridges are, you know, it's not high, it's not hazardous, because mm-hmm. we're inhaling these things into our lungs. And the one big piece is that we're focusing on, okay, the cartridge itself is really bad for the environment, but we have things like heavy metals and toxins and leads that are leaking from the coils that are heating up this these chemicals in order for us to inhale it. And those are super dangerous. Yeah. So the things that we want to look for is to make sure that it's lab tested, that the cannabis oil or the concentrate or the distillate, whatever is going to be in your cartridge, is lab tested. Mm-hmm. So it's healthy and it's good and it's clean.
Is that going to be on the label when you say lab tested? Where is the consumer going to find that information?
The company should have that. If the company does not have that, mm-hmm. then refuse to purchase.
Okay, so that's a warning sign, basically, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
If they don't have a lab-tested mark, or that it's, I guess other things we want to look for is organic as much as possible. And,
absolutely.
I guess if they don't list any additional, I mean, do we know, can you just have pure cannabis oil without all the additives, or
of course.
Are the additives necessary?
Nope. I don't particularly believe that any of those additives are necessary. That the more additives you can place with the cannabis, the cheaper the product is going to be, which means the cheaper for the consumer.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so
they're cutting it with that stuff is what they're doing.
Absolutely. So there are a couple things, and we can come back to another point that I'm going to make about the particular cartridge in a moment. But the three things they're cutting them with is, it's called a PEG, which is a polyethanol glycose. Oh. And it's a cutting agent that's used for the vape liquids to keep the product evenly mixed. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't really have to have that if it's just straight cannabis. That doesn't make any sense. You use that cutting agent to put into those vape liquids that are cut with other things. What are those things? PG, for example. PG is propylene glycol, and that is a thing that actually helps foster it's an interesting binding agent that helps foster even more vape draws. So it makes the cannabis, or whatever the combination in there, it makes it last longer, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that. And another really popular agent is VG, or just vegetable glycerin, which you think that sounds pretty harmless, but there's really no reason for it, except for that it's added to those kind of vape liquids for cartridges and pens to help generate larger clouds of smoke for the user. So there's
bad.
This big, I know,
yeah, it's like so
there's
bad.
This big thing called pluming, where you smoke and then you, exhale, and there's this big plume, is what it's called. So then vegetable glycerin's in there. So none of this is cannabis related. So mm-hmm. if you're really looking for a vape cartridge or a vape pen that's on the medicinal level, you're not going to have any of that stuff in it mm-hmm. at all. You're going to have clean, organic cannabis, and the consumer just, without knowing these things, it just doesn't make sense. So there again, I don't even go that direction, because really terpenes, cannabinoids, they start to break down at 150 to 260 degrees.
It's too hot. Can you give us the name of a couple of companies you might recommend that have good quality vape cartridges?
I can't give you names of just a couple. I mean, there are a mm-hmm. lot out there, but another thing I would look for is that the company has other concentrates.
Okay.
So they're not just selling one particular thing, right? They're selling also the butter or the shatter or the diamonds or the crumble. They've got a lot of different things that I know we'll go into that another day, but they're really, really looking at cannabis and breaking it down in all the ways that they can, as well as the really important piece here is that if you're looking at a vape cartridge or a vape pen and you still want to do that, make sure that the materials that are being used don't have heavy metals, toxins in them, because mm-hmm. then you're getting that heated and those chemicals you're drawing into your lungs. And I think that with the agents that they're adding, that's what's causing the issues, not the cannabis.
Wow.
Those two big pieces.
good insight from Dr. Hernandez on how to select vape pens. We're going to come back to this, but this is a very serious area that we want to have a heads up on. One last thought. What's your final thought on vape pens and your final recommendation?
Personally, no need.
you're not a fan.
Not at all. Yeah. I just think there's so many better ways to get cannabis into your system. Mm-hmm. And if you like a really potent THC, vaping like that, there's other ways to go about it. There's just so many.
Okay, excellent. All right, thanks for the heads up. We are still working on our main website, Destiny 2020, but you can email us at earthancients.com until we get our other site up, and I can put you in direct contact. Also, remember, Dr. Hernandez has a website, drpepperhernandez.com. You can check out her website. Also, go to YouTube, Dr. Pepper Hernandez, and look at her cannabis series of videos. They're excellent. Also, she breaks down the terpenes in a really easy to understand language. So, all right, Dr. Hernandez, as always, fantastic, and we will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Cliff.
What happens when we die? What's the next place we go to after we've been physical for a lifetime? Today, my guest has a deep understanding of this place through the loss of his child, his son, Jordan. And in the past, I personally have had authors and speakers talk about the experience of death, the near-death experience, but those individuals came back. Today, we're going to hear about an individual who passed over into a place, a spirit level, and has been communicating with his father, our guest today, in the most profound manner I've heard about. We're speaking with Dr. Matthew McKay. And he has written a book called The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife: Jordan's Message to the Living on What to Expect After Death. Now, Dr. McKay, Matt McKay, is a clinical psychologist, professor of psychology at the Wright Institute, and he's written a number of other books. And this is this book, The Luminous Landscape, is a follow-up to another book called Seeking Jordan. And we're going to learn just about how in-depth this spirit realm, I guess what we can expect from the time we leave physicality. Matt, welcome to Earth Ancients. How are you doing today?
I'm great. It's glad to be with you, Cliff.
Really great to have you. First of all, I can't imagine losing a child in the manner that you lost Jordan. I have a son myself. And I have to ask you this. Let's lead up to the point where he passed over. What were the circumstances of his death?
He was on his way home from work. He lived with his girlfriend in San Francisco. He was on his way home. He's riding his bike. It's pretty late at night. And four men accost him. It seems like they just wanted to steal the bike. And there's a tremendous fight that ensued. And the neighbors, witnessed. He broke away from them, began running down the street, and someone shot him in the back, and he died in a doorway. So that was a catastrophic moment for him, for me, and for everyone who loved him. And at that moment, I think this is something you could probably imagine too as a parent, that all that matters to you is my child, are they still sentient? Do they still exist? And are they okay? Those are the things that are so compelling, and just everything you care about is really those two questions. And so I just felt this tremendous need to see if I could make contact with him, to seek him, to find him in some way, and you know, learn, does he still exist? How is he? And so I set out on a journey. I worked with mediums, and I did something called induced after death communication. Alan Botkin is a psychologist like me who uses EMDR, which is a way of treating trauma, but through a small accident with the protocol for EMDR, he discovered a way of actually making contact with the other side. And so I went to see Botkin in Chicago, and I had that experience that I could hear Jordan in the room. I experienced him as literally talking to me and saying the things that I had so desperately needed to hear, that he existed. He was good. He was okay in the afterlife. He still had us. He still loved us. He still watched over us. So those were very important things to learn. And my grief softened a little bit at hearing that and having that experience. But I wanted to actually have a conversation with him. This was a one-way communication where I was just hearing his voice telling me the things that he knew that I needed to hear. But I wanted to be able to ask questions. I wanted to be able to engage with him. And so I learned how to do channeling from Ralph Messer, the late Ralph Messer was a psychologist, but also a specialist in the afterlife and in how to communicate to the afterlife. So he taught me how to channel. And it turned out to be something, I will have to say to your audience that it's pretty easy to do. You don't have to be clairaudient or have any special powers or psychic abilities to channel. Mm-hmm. If anyone wants to know how to do it, I can explain it today. But learning how to channel now gave me a chance to have the experience of actually conversing. And I had big questions. Where is he? What kind of place is this? What is his experience there? What was his death like? And what happened after he died? So I had all kinds of questions, and he was very generous and willing to take a lot of time to really explain to me what that world and afterlife looks like. And he eventually said, "We need to write a book because there's a lot of fear of death. People, struggle tremendously. They don't know what's out there. They don't know what to expect. And I can show them how to prepare for death and what's out there and help them with the fear of death." So that was kind of where the book came from.
I find it fascinating that it was Jordan's suggestion that, "Hey, Dad, let's put a book together because I think people need this information." I mean, just for that communication alone, in some ways validates your work together, because here you are, a clinical psychologist with a community that's going, "What the hell's McKay doing here? He's not using the traditions that we have come to accept in our community. He's going out of the bounds," which in many ways people would think, okay, he's gone to the occult side and he's channeling. And I'm very personally very familiar with the channeling phenomenon. But for Jordan to say, "Hey, let's create a book," that must have surprised you.
I was very surprised. Although, to be truthful, in life we'd had projects, so we would make a piece of furniture together, or we had things that we did together and shared. And so I sort of experienced it here's another project, and we're just doing this project on either side of the veil, but doing it together in the way we did other things. But he also has very strong convictions about, you know, because I'm a writer, and you know, he could use me basically as a scribe to convey things that he thinks are important that he wants living people to know. And so he sees it as an opportunity for him to get knowledge out and available that isn't out there and isn't available in any other way except for hearing from someone who's dead.
Yeah. Talk about the process, because channel data comes in different ways. There's the trans channel, where someone goes into a light trance. There is a automatic writing, which sounds like what kind of what you do, where the information comes through, you step aside, part of your consciousness steps aside. And what form of channeling comes through to you?
Yeah. So I use automatic writing, and I have, you know, a place where I always do it, where I feel safe and comfortable. And I have a talisman, something that belonged to Jordan that I always have present with me. I use something for eye fixation. The candles work great. I use something to create an altered state. It's a kind of a Vipassana type meditation, just focusing on the breath, which really shifts your attention and drops it inward. But also, there's a method of opening the channel. It's basically a divination where you visualize an orb of light just a little bit over your head, and then you watch it elongate all the way up. So that becomes the open channel. And as I visualize that, I experience the channel opening, and I can experience Jordan starting to reach out to me through the channel.
Is this what Ralph Mentzer provided you, this technique? Yeah, because yes. He's been doing this stuff for years.
Yes, and this is exactly what he taught me to do.
Yeah,
and I took it. I remember him teaching it to me. I said, "That's ridiculously simple," and you know, all I have to do is meditate and have a little some kind of icon from Jordan and visualize this channel opening up. And he says, well, yeah, but you have to have a notebook to, you know, write your questions down and be prepared to write the answer. So this is all, you know, so you're converting this into physical words and letters. Mm-hmm. He says, that's it. That's all you have to do. And so I went home and I was a little skeptical. And I followed the procedure that he laid out, just what I described. And I asked a question. And this is important, I think, is to be kind of open. You don't expect anything. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know, and just allow the very first word that shows up. Just write that down. Don't question it. Don't try to, you know, what does that mean? Just write the first word down, and then wait. And in a little while, something else will show up, and the sentence will complete. And if you wait a little longer, maybe another sentence or two will show up. And in the beginning, the communications are pretty short. After a while, the channel gets really well oiled, if we might say.
Lubricated, yeah.
And so, they're much more elaborate communications. And they come in different ways. Sometimes the communications come as kind of a total download, where you just get knowledge, but then you have to go find the words to actually
interesting.
Make sense of the knowledge. But you can have, I had at one time from Jordan, and a complete psychotherapy show up. The complete psychotherapy showed up as within 3 or 4 seconds.
Wow.
And I you know, got it. And then eventually had to find words to describe everything that I received at that moment. Mm-hmm. And actually turned it into a psychotherapy that I use in my trauma clinic.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Other times it's kind of a rush where you just get a big bunch of words and you can hardly keep up with it. You know, just get this huge rush of communication. And otherwise, and there are other times it's very distilled. You'll get a few words and they have, you know, great meaning and import. So, and I guess I just want to encourage people to recognize that these communications can come in different ways. When you're channeling, it can show up differently. But the most important thing is just to be open, without question, without judgment, without even any thought, is just to write down the first word or even the first syllable that shows up in your mind, and then just wait and know that eventually more will come and something will make sense. But it doesn't necessarily make sense the first moment that you receive it.
Before we get into specifics on what Jorn is currently experiencing, I'm curious about this channeling, the experience that you go through. It's obvious from the way you're talking that you've become very comfortable with the process. But would you say, you just gave an indication that this data comes in different quantities, either huge downloads or sporadic, question after question. Does it come as visual elements that you convert into words? Or are they a combination of feeling, visual, and words that you translate?
It's very rare for me to have it show up as an image, a visual image. Now, what I told you earlier about that therapy, the download I had, that actually showed up as a visual image. I could see each part of the therapy in relationship. And it was in a kind of a diamond shape, and all of the parts of the therapy were there ranging around the edges of the diamond. But in fact, most of the time, it's just a stream of words that I get. And depending on, the channel is, the quality of the channel varies, sometimes I have other emotions that are going on. And distracted, things that are happening for me. The channel may not be as easily opened. And so the words come more slowly, it's more halting. At other times, and in the case of much of the book, which is all channeled, it's not, none of it is me. I actually would experience, I could barely keep up with writing as fast as I was getting information. And he was forming the sentences, and I was just doing my best to keep up with what I was hearing. So yeah, it varies, and the quality of the channel varies depending on what kind of state I'm in.
I mean, as an example, when you begin your process, your connection with him, is it like, hey, Jorn, this is Dad. What's going on? I have this question. We left this off last time. I need to drill down on this a little more. I mean, is it that kind of a question, like we're conversing right now, or is it something else where because he's not physical anymore, he kind of cuts to the chase and it's like, okay, hey, how you doing? This is the answer to this question. I mean, I'm just curious about the process, and I may be asking something that you can't describe because it's so automatic. But I'm just curious about the process, because this is, I mean, like I said before, there's different levels of channeling that I've studied that have been documented. And when somebody kind of leaves their consciousness and lets this other source in, that's one way. But it sounds to me like you're fully present, and you're part of you is shifting, and that shifted area allows you enough space where you can think about what he's saying, but also get it down on paper.
Yeah, it's definitely a shift. I feel like I'm in an altered state. It's not huge like I'm in a deep hypnotic trance. I mean, I do hypnosis. I know what that feels like, but it's not a trance-like state. But it feels different from my normal state. I feel a sense of opening. I also actually feel sensations in the top of my head that typically occur when the channel is open, and I can feel a very definite sensation in my scalp that is that always seems to accompany the opening of the channel. When it opens, oftentimes it's like Jorn starts talking immediately. And he usually often begins by talking about something that pertains to me, like giving me advice, and he's full of advice for me, which I'm very grateful for. I mean, it helps guide my life, really, the things that he offers and suggests. And so it oftentimes just starts with you know, things that he's wanting me to know about, because he's observing my experience. He's watching my watching over me, and he has some things to say about what's going on. But then it shifts. And if we're in the middle, say there's a chapter that we're writing, or there's a topic that we're working on, right now we're working on something called, you know, what he's wanting to talk about is the nature of reality, which is a very big question.
Wow.
So that's a topic that he's exploring in different ways from different vantage points now. But when we're doing Luminous Landscape, we'd be in the middle of a chapter, some part of the book. He'd outline the whole book in the space of about a minute. at the very beginning, just outline, here's what it's going to be, chapter 1, 2, 3, and then each chapter is going to be about. Here it goes. You know, the first chapter is going to be about his experience of his death and what happened in the immediate afterlife. And then each chapter thereafter covers some aspect of the afterlife. So he laid it all out. And so whatever we were in the middle of, he would just continue where he left off. And
wow.
And so I wouldn't even have to do anything. I would just sit there and write, and he would continue where we left off. Now, sometimes I'd have questions to clarify. So I'd write down my question, and then he would clarify or make sense or elaborate on what he was saying. Now, in other situations, you know, where we're not working on something specific, like, you know, specific topic, I will ask questions, and I will write, you know, the questions out and then wait and hear what he has to say. So, you know, we do it in different ways. Sometimes he's just spontaneously saying things, and I'm just listening and taking it in. Other times we're working on a mutual project, and he's in the middle of it, and he just starts where he left off, and off mm-hmm. we go. And other times we actually have conversations in which I ask questions and he provides answers. You know, I mean, for example, you know, I've been very curious, you know, he's already incarnated again. I've been very curious about his new wow. life. He's a little girl, living, he's about 8 or 9 years old, living in a community, with a single mom and so forth. And so sometimes we'll have conversations about what this current incarnation is.
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, and the conversation can be wide ranging in terms of, you know, what's going on for me, what's going on in his new life, or even what he's working on in terms of things he's learning in the afterlife, in the spirit world. He has things that he has a spiritual career that he's learning a craft up there. You know, he's, you know, becoming a guide. And so he'll tell me about experiences that are helping him learn these new spiritual skills. Anyway, so the topics can be very wide ranging.
It's amazing to hear you speak in this manner. Has he presented to you that this was meant to be in his life, that he would pass at the age that he did, and that you would be communicating in the manner that you are right now?
Yes, he has been very clear that he expected, and that we all agreed, that he would have a short life, and that there are certain things he was learning in this life that were very important, that were going to be preparing him for subsequent incarnations, but he could learn those things in a brief period of time, and he was not expected to learn and live long. And his death was going to set in motion a lot of different, it would impact many, many, many lives around him. And he showed me that, how,
wow.
Yeah, now speaking of an image, he showed me the image of all these lives being impacted, these humans who are, you know, currently embodied, living incarnated lives, you know, how his death would have a huge cause and effect rolling out over all of these many lives. So there was, you know, there was a purpose to his death, and it was part of a plan that apparently we all agreed to. My wife kind of kids and says, listen, when we agreed to that, I was in the bathroom. I never. I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, I can see, you know, it's like, hey, I didn't sign up for this, but no, she did, whether she likes it or not. One real quick question, and this is on a personal note. Do you find relief from this work you do with Jordan? I mean, what a trauma to have to lose a child at such a young age, especially one that you were as close to as Jordan. Would you say that when you have this, do this work, that you find that it is a healing practice, this channel work, or what would you describe it as?
It's very healing. I can't tell you. I can't even describe. I can feel teary as I talk about it. I can't describe how important it is for me to have contact with him. And I feel like we're having conversations just like we used to in our kitchen.
That's wonderful.
In life. And I feel connected to him. I feel his presence. I feel his loving care for me. And it's very active. And it's one of the things I try to do as a psychologist. I work quite a bit with
people who are
in grief. And I, you know, show them how to make contact with their loved one through channeling. And almost universally, people are able to do that, and they get the same benefit, that they have a real relationship now that continues after death. Death doesn't sever the relationship. They experience it as ongoing, as a living, vital relationship that can evolve. That they continue as with each conversation, the relationship strengthens and evolves. So, and that's the main thing that I think Jordan wants people to know, is that there is, you know, death doesn't impact, doesn't sever, doesn't change the relationships to those we love. Those relationships stay completely intact and are strong. And those loved ones are just a thought away, and we can open that channel to them when we want.
That's great. That's amazing. All right, let's get into it. Let's, first of all, provide the listening audience with Jordan's description of immediately after death. What is the landing exactly? What, talk a little bit about that process, because I think most people that have read about the near death experiences, that people go to a certain level in the death process and then they come back, where now Jordan is providing the entry point and then what happens after, and then he's providing really wonderful details about the spirit world. So if you could talk a little bit about the first phase of this passing over.
Well, the landing place is really kind of an antechamber to the spirit world. It's right next to the spirit world, but it's not in the spirit world. So most souls, or many souls, arrive at the landing place. And I'll talk about some exceptions in a moment, but most souls arrive in the landing place, and it's prepared for us. Guides create an image through energy. The landing place is not physical, but there are energetic patterns in which we can see things, and we see often very familiar things from our life on whatever planet we incarnated on, things that are comforting. Loved ones show up to greet us. The guides are there to greet us and to orient us. And there's this kind of a place where, it's like the orientation before you go to college. You know, it's like,
yeah,
like this place where you're kind of getting used to, you're getting used to, having, lost all your senses, yet you can see 360. You actually perceive 360. You move by intention, not by moving your legs. And basically, the most problematic thing in that place is whatever you're thinking, whatever thought you have, can manifest as a hallucination. And so you can actually start seeing things that aren't there, that have not been part of what was prepared for you. And Jordan actually describes, first of all, he was, thinking about his home, and he starts hallucinating his house, And then he tries to calm himself and thinks about the place that he was most, where he feels most comfortable and safe. He starts thinking about Yosemite, and he can see, suddenly sees Yosemite Falls is crashing down. And then he has some idea about, you know, a thought occurs to him about an elephant, and suddenly the elephant is in the middle of Yosemite Valley. I mean, he's got, he's having all of these images. Now, other souls show up in the landing place who have, you know, are struggling with very disturbing emotions, maybe surrounding their death, or that their life had been dominated by very painful emotions. And sometimes these emotions are generating very disturbing images. And so this can be really problematic in the landing place. Other souls don't even know they're dead, and they're very confused. They don't know what's going on. And so the landing place, for many souls is a kind of a sorting center. It's like, you know, people get ready to move on into the afterlife and do life review and all the things that they're going to be doing shortly. And other souls are not at all ready for that. They're struggling with overwhelming emotions. They're not sure that they're dead. They're not even aware of where they are, what's going on. And primarily that happens because they arrive in the afterlife or in the landing place. Jordan says as DOA, death on arrival. Death on arrival means what is the medium of communication in the afterlife? It's love. And if you're not tuned to love, if you're not tuned and aware of what love sounds like, looks like, feels like, the guides can't communicate to you, and your loved ones who show up can't communicate to you. You're deaf on arrival. You just cannot hear the communications that are being directed to you. And so folks who are deaf, who are really struggling with overwhelming emotions, who really can't hear love, can't experience it, can't get those messages and communications, have to go to the bardos. And these are places, they're healing places where a lot of these painful emotions are slowly healed. The energy, the soul energy is remodeled by guides and so forth. Sometimes they go to bardos where they are actually living out scenarios and scenes and dramas that they haven't fully resolved in their life. Maybe they were a very angry soul, and so now they're living out dramas in which they feel like they're being victimized and harmed. No real harm comes to them, but they live out these dramas in these bardos as a healing process to get ready to finally move into the.
That's an amazing description. It's like somebody has had a life of trauma or anger or hate, or they were abusing people. And what you say is very profound, and I think our listening audience needs to key on that this spirit world is bathed and formulated with love is what you're saying. I mean, that's just to hear that, because you know, as physical beings, love is important. I think it nurtures us quite a bit, but it's very important in the spirit world, isn't it? I mean, it seems to be the glue.
It is. It's the glue. It's what holds everything together. What holds every soul to every other soul, and all souls to universal or collective consciousness, God. But here's what Jordan describes. The metaphor he uses is love in the spirit world is like air in the world we live in. You know, it's a source of life. You know, we breathe it. It's a source of life, but also when we communicate to each other, we make those air molecules vibrate, and that's how we hear each other. You know, so the air is the medium through which we communicate. Well, love is the medium through which we communicate in the afterlife. And that's why Jordan says when we arrive with these overwhelming emotions and you know, anger, greed, fear, whatever it is, it makes it hard for us to hear and see and experience love that's all around us. We just don't get it. And so we often have to spend time healing and in these bardos of working through some of those painful feelings. It's not, we're not banished from the spirit world. We just have to work our way to the point where we can hear and see love. And when we get to that point, we're ready to enter spirit.
I think one of the important aspects of the book that I caught, and you can presented in more detail is that there's no bad or good when you leave the spirit world. You could be a son of a bitch in the physical world, like a Hitler or somebody, but when you enter the spirit world, it's like, okay, we'll review what you've done and let's think about this. Was this a positive life or a negative life, so forth and so on. And in this review, I guess there's healing and learning. It's all about learning, isn't it?
That's right. That's exactly right. I couldn't say it better myself. Let me just say that there is no judgment in the spirit world. There's no hell. There's no decision that some soul has not lived up to, you know, some minimum requirement to enter the golden gates, you know, that doesn't exist. It's all love, but it's also true that we have to face the life we've lived. We have to make sense of it. And so some of that may be done in the bardos, but for many souls, the first stop, once they get through the gates of the spirit world, is the life review. And the life review is a very extraordinary experience because the soul goes into a kind of a trance and reviews every moment of their life from beginning to end. And, you know, sometimes we talk about, you know, near-death experiences, how they, you know, our life flashes before our eyes. Well, the soul reviews every single moment of the experience. But the difference is not just the experience as they experienced it, but the experience as everyone around them who is touched by their behavior,
wow,
and choices, experiences. So they have to experience it entirely, by each individual around them, what that was like. And not only at that moment, but how that particular choice or behavior affected people rolling into the future. So for every moment of our lives, we end up being aware of, reviewing and observing how what we did affected everyone now and ongoingly. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge undertaking.
Can't imagine.
And it takes, you know, spirit time is different than earth time, but it takes a good while to go through that review. It's very careful. And for souls who have lived less than stellar lives, you know, where they've induced a lot of pain, caused a lot of pain, they're going to have a very challenging life review. Now, there are souls who have done, you know, evil at such a level that they're afraid of a life review. They don't want to face it, and they really live in the anti world. They don't get into spirit world. They have to live in one of the bardos, because you have to be willing to face what you did and how you lived in order to move deeper into.
So, are you saying the bardos is a qualification before moving on? You have to process your life and then you move on to the review.
Well, you have to heal from some of these painful emotions. You may need to process your life in various ways. Like I said, you can enter scenes and scenarios that play out different aspects of and conflicts and struggles of your life, working them through. Guides may drop new little twists and turns into the plot line of this life, you know, you're living in a bardo, that gradually help you recognize the truth of who you are and heal from some of the emotional pain that you may have experienced. So there's a lot of work that's done in the bardos to prepare you to get into the spirit world, to heal the emotions that would make it impossible for you to heal, hear and feel and see love there.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of work there, but there are people that have lived lives that were so catastrophic for others, created such pain for others that they are afraid to face life review. So they really live in these shadow worlds until they can decide to face life review. We'll be right back.
That's so funny to hear that. It's like they have a decision. It's almost, I would think that it'd be like the higher ups, the old souls or the teachers of the spirit world would say, okay, you're transitioning now. This is just the process we do. But you're saying they actually have a choice.
They have to go through life review. Every soul has to go through life review. And if you don't, and you are not ready for that, then you wait. That's a choice that you have as a soul.
That's fascinating. Talk a little bit about, I mean, we don't have a great deal of time here. It's almost like I need to come back and meet with you again, but talk about time in the spirit world, because I was flabbergasted when I read that. I was like, wait a minute. I thought there's no time accountability in the spirit world. What's the difference?
That's really interesting. I'm glad you're asking about that. Well, just to contrast the time that, you know, from the spirit world, in spirit, you can look at the entire history of the earth. You can see it from beginning to end. And so that's, you know, and we can incarnate to at any moment in history, as long as, you know, as long as they were humanoids that could support consciousness, soul conscious. So we can go back and incarnate in caveman era or in a future era of some, you know, modern city and whatever. Souls typically incarnate sequentially on Earth time because it's less unsettling to them. There are familiar elements in that new life that they recognize from the old life. You know, so a soul that died in the 1920s and incarnated in 1995, well, there's still automobiles and there are still things that are familiar. So there's something about that actually souls kind of gravitate to lives that are proximate to a life just lived. But they could choose to incarnate at any point in human history. So, but how is that different from time in, as measured in the afterlife in the spirit world? So, in the spirit world, you know, time is always the measurement of change, right? And that whether it's a rock eroding away or a mountain range upthrusting or settling back. Before you had breakfast and after you had breakfast, time is always a measurement of something that is changing. Well, it's also true in the spirit world, but it's different. What's changing in the spirit world is awareness, is knowledge. Collective consciousness continues to grow, as does each individual soul grow in knowledge and awareness. And so there is the moment before we knew something and the moment after we knew something. Excuse me. And that's how time is measured in the spirit world. It's the before and after of a particular experience and acquired.
Give us an example. Like, I would think that in the life review, if they took a segment that said, okay, between the age of this and this, that's a time factor. So in other words, we're reviewing your childhood from 18 year old to say 25. This was a significant part. We're reviewing that. And so is that what you're saying the spirit time is as you're reviewing?
Yes and no. If you're learning something during the review, there's before, you know, let's say you suddenly realize, oh, when I didn't pay any attention to my wife's pain, how that really affected her. I wasn't noticing, you know, her sadness, or I wasn't noticing what was going on, how that affected. Well, I may not have been terribly aware of that in my life, but now in life review, I really notice how my behavior and demeanor affected her on a very deep level because I experienced it as she experienced it. Well, I'm learning something. So there was before I knew that, which was just before I saw that in my life review. And there's after I learned that, which is, you know, a moment after when I had digested this knowledge that, oh my God, when I wasn't paying attention to her pain or feelings, this had a certain kind of impact on her. So now I've learned that. And that's knowledge that I hold inside of me as a soul. Mm-hmm. But there are all kinds of things we learn. For example, one of the things that souls do a lot is they learn their, you know, spiritual careers. Jordan, for example, is learning how to be a guide. So for example, he may engage in implanting a certain thought in an incarnate who he's helping to guide. He's going to be planting a thought, some idea that might help them move in a more positive direction, or he may even create a dream in which they see or understand something. So he's working as a guide. Well, there, and then some of the things he does well, and some of the things he doesn't, they don't work out so well, right? So like, and he's learning how to be a guide. As he learns, there are things that he learns that he didn't know before, and now there's things that he knows about being a guide as time goes on. And so time and spirit world is before he knew it and after he knew it.
So I guess it's still fuzzy to me, because I'm thinking, okay, it took me a half an hour to walk around the block during my my constitutional. Okay. In the spirit world, it's not measured in minutes. It's measured in activity. Is that what you're suggesting?
Measured in change. For example, if you had walked, you know, in the spirit world, if I, let's say I was, there's a lot of recreation in the spirit world. So let's say I'm making some music in the spirit world, music in the way they created in the spirit. Well, and if I'm not learning anything, there's nothing changes. Essentially time doesn't march on. I haven't learned anything. I haven't experienced anything. On the other hand, let's say I created a piece of music in the spirit world. Well, I learned how to arrange sounds in such a way that it was pleasing, and I considered it a piece, something that was a finished piece. Well, there would be before I learned to do that and after I learned to do that. So before and after is the change. Before I hadn't done that yet, and I hadn't learned how to make those sounds in a particular way. And now afterwards, I learned how to make those sounds in a particular harmonic way that was pleasing to me and maybe pleasing to others. And so that is a measure. That's how time would be measured, before I did that and after I did that, before I learned how to make those sounds and after I learned how to make those sounds.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, it's funny because, Matt, it's like, I don't think time, time fits the spirit world. There's another word for it that we just haven't invented yet, there's another description of the action of this review that we call time, but in the spirit world, Jordan gives you the word time, but it's not really time. It's something else.
A better word would be growth.
Oh, okay.
Growth is, it's like time in the spirit world is just simply the observation of growth. How I grow.
I like that.
Awareness, ability, the things I know how to do that I didn't know how to do before, things I've learned that I didn't know before. That growth is how time is measured there.
Okay, very cool. I'm going to ask you a really quick question that just came to mind, and I don't know if you can answer it or not, but what does Jordan say about the composition of the spirit world? We're a physical, blood, flesh, cellular entity, but in the spirit world, you know, I think of ghosts, you know, these wisps of fog or whatever the hell they call it. What would you say is the spirit? What is it something that you can see with your eye or whatever the perception tools are as a spirit? What is it? What is the visual of the spirit? Is that such a term?
Yeah, no,
we're trying to make words of something that may not be able to describe.
Absolutely. No, it's a great thing to consider. The spirit world is made of energy. And the main way the energy is expressed is in light. The spirit world is often described as a vast array of lights. In fact, I do life between life regressions, and people using hypnosis, and people can go back and start actually experiencing the spirit world. And somebody recently said, you know, I just see lights, and there's too many to count. It's not in the billions; it's in the trillions. It's just an enormous array of lights, and that's, I've heard that description many times. So and oftentimes when you're doing regression, and soul will describe coming into the spirit world, and they'll just see this vast array of light. So light is how it's manifested. Now, on the level of the individual soul, or the souls that are living in their soul group, which is a little soul family, they may create all kinds of images around them, but they're made of energy. They're not made of matter, but they're made of energy. So they can create houses. They can create environments. Jordan says, you know, their soul group, you know, over the years has created many different kinds of environments. Typically, they live in a Victorian house now, but but this is, again, it's made out of energy. It's not made out of matter. And it can be changed by agreement. If the souls in the soul group decide that they want to change the energy images that surround them, they can do so by choice, by will. So it's light and it's energy. And of course, light is energy. And this is sort of maybe a little esoteric, but the energy is derived from thought, the thought of God, you know, God or all there is, the collective consciousness, which is all of us, includes all of us. Mm-hmm. The thoughts actually translate into energy. Thought is energy, and thoughts translate into energy, and the energies translate into images, into light and images. So the spirit world is made of energy. And our souls are made of energy.
Amazing. One of the things that you bring up is the farm.
Yeah.
And this is a collection of, well, to describe the farm for us, I'm just really curious.
It's the term that Jordan and his soul group use for their soul group. They call it the farm. And this particular soul group tends to work collectively on a certain spiritual skill, and also a skill that they're going to use in their incarnate lives. It's the skill of creating collective change in consciousness. That just sounds very grand, but I mean, you know, basically when you think about, you know, how do you change consciousness on a mass level? When you think about something like what Martin Luther King did, how did he change consciousness? How did Mandela change consciousness? How did, you know, the great leaders or even people in small influence groups, you know, how do they change consciousness of the people around them, souls around? How do they create, progressive ideas or help the souls, the individuals around them move in a positive direction. So the laws of change, their particular soul group, which they call the farm, which is what they're doing, is growing laws of change. They're growing methods and processes to help souls or consciousness change, particularly incarnate consciousness. How do you come to Earth and help people move toward greater awareness, away from memes of selfishness and, focusing on tribe and toward more awareness of all and all of the collected awareness of all of us humans as a group, rather than just individual tribes and individual families and so forth. So the movement of consciousness away from the individual, the tribe, toward all, this process is an enormous undertaking, and souls come to Earth with the goal of helping us move our consciousness forward, and the laws of change, how we influence and change the minds and awareness of others. And so Jordan and his soul group are learning that, and they're working on those laws of change and learning more about them, and then taking them with that knowledge with them into their incarnate lives to make ripples of change around them in each individual life.
Okay, now here, that's fascinating, and I really appreciate that description. But I want to get a sense of what happens when we leave physicality and go into the spirit world. And you describe something that I've heard about before, which is as a consciousness leaving body and entering the spirit world, Jordan was an individual, but he's more also part of a collective consciousness, which is almost like massive. I mean, I think there's a part of the book where he describes to you that, yes, I was Jordan, but I'm also more than Jordan. So talk a little bit about that, because it's a little confusing because the farm is specific individuals, whereas the higher, the greater Jordan is a collection of.
Well, Jordan is a collection of lifetimes, perhaps, you know, more than 100 lifetimes. And so all of the knowledge and the experience he's had in those lifetimes and those different roles he's had are all now part of this larger Jordan. And not just the lifetimes he's lived, but his experiences in the afterlife, the things he's learned there are now all are part of this expanded Jordan. And then his experience of the whole, one of the things that we do in the afterlife is, of course, we spend most of our time with our soul group, and we have various learning experiences that we're engaging in with our soul family, this little family of, you know, like 7 or 8 to 20 souls that we all are very close. And we have a nearby soul group. So it's just like, you know, people who live in the neighborhood, the souls that live in the neighborhood that we also interact with and learn with and recreate with. But then there's also this experience that souls have of merging with all. And they can choose at various times. They can do it frequently or infrequently, for short periods or long periods. They can merge with the total consciousness of all all that is. And it's Jordan describes it like a wire that carries a lot more electricity than the wire is rated for. And so when
you're high voltage.
Yes. So you're connecting to all, and the wire you're connecting with is your little individual consciousness, which you know isn't really built to carry all that high voltage. So anyway, so you're downloading knowledge, experience, awareness, incredible sense of the full breadth of what all there is, all that consciousness has ever learned. I mean, this is all sort of available for downloads. Now, of course, you can't get it all at once. But you're having this download. You're experiencing all this, and it's very intense. And young souls who are, you know, relatively immature can only do it for a brief period of time. Then the wire gets so damn hot that they got to let go, right? Whereas souls that are a little more experienced have a higher voltage wire to connect to all with, and they may be able to do it for longer periods of time. They may also, Jordan says, be able to direct their attention. They can treat all it is as the total collective consciousness as a library, and they can actually direct their attention to learning very specific things from all. Whereas younger souls may just get this, you know, overwhelming, you know, download of information that they don't know quite how to sort or what to do with. So this merging with all is an important thing that we do, and it's part of what the totality of Jordan includes, those experiences as well. The experience of merging with all and what he learns from that, the experiences of what he learns with his soul group and his soul career that he's working on, you know, being a guide, and all of his incarnations. So the totality of Jordan is so much more than his experience as my son and his experience for 23 years in this life. I mean, let me give you another tiny little slice of this, if I could. You know, Ralph would also do past life regressions with me, Ralph Messner. And one of the past lives, Jordan and I are in a yeshiva, a Jewish place of learning where rabbis develop and learn and read the Torah and other sacred texts. And I was a a young rabbi, and he was older rabbi, and he and I became very close in that yeshiva, and I learned a lot from him, and I had this deep connection to him. And when he died in that life, I was connecting to him as I am now, through channeling,
wow,
telling me things about how things really are that are very different from the orthodoxy of the yeshiva. So I'm getting this download from Jordan about how things really, you know, in the afterlife and in terms of how things really are. Some of our belief systems down here in the yeshiva are really kind of bunk. And I'm getting all this stuff. And so I'm passing this on to the other rabbis, and they ostracize me. They think I'm a nut. And I'm getting all this stuff from Jordan, and I'm telling them, you know, no, it's not like that. It's like this. We should interpret the Torah this way, not that way. And they don't kick me out, but they basically shun me. And so in some ways, Jordan and I think resolved to come back in this life and be able to do that same thing we did then, but do it differently.
That was my next question, Matt, is that down through history, and I can think of the Greeks and so forth, channeling was an accepted form of divination.
Yeah.
Today, because of our intellectualizing everything and science being the all divine, we don't look at it because it's poo-pooed as a form of, if you're religious, heresy, you know.
Yeah.
But do you think, or does Jordan convey to you that what you're doing should be done more regularly so we have a better evolution as a humanity?
Well, I think one of the things he's saying is that we need to listen to what's coming through from the other side, whether it's in the form of guides whispering to us into our own personal consciousness, or sources that we get from mediums, psychics, channeled communications of all kinds, that there's, really important information there. And, since the late 1800s, there's an incredible agreement, really, in terms of what we are hearing from very varied channelers. There's lots of different people who've channeled, and what they describe in the afterlife, there's a lot of commonality. And so we need to listen to that. And Jordan is adding his voice to that. He's saying, look, here's what the afterlife looks like to someone who's there. And not just to, pay attention to that and see that as maybe a way of feeling less afraid of death, but also to prepare for it, and he wants to, like all of the great books of the dead, the Egyptian, the Tibetan books of the dead, the Jordan's book is really a modern book of the dead that's just about how to get ready for this transition, and there are meditations and methods for getting ready. Let me give you a tiny little example. For the fear of death, Jordan has a very simple meditation that works really beautifully. So you breathe in love and you breathe out fear. And when a thought arises, you let go of the thought and return to your breath, breathing in love, breathing out fear, breathing in love, breathing out fear. It's the most calming thing. And it's a way of kind of getting ready for the afterlife, because the number one way we can get ready for the afterlife is to prepare with love. Think about the people that we love that are in the afterlife, expect to see them, anticipate their presence and their guidance when we arrive, including our guides, and see what you can do to cultivate love in your daily life. Start with a morning intention. Every morning, start with the intention: how can I bring love to every moment of my life today? Every moment of choice, how can I bring love to that? To that choice, to that moment, and to pay attention to the moment of choice. Moments of choice are when you're feeling strong emotions or strong desires or pain or what have you. There's all these moments of choice that show up, and they're usually in interactions with other people. They're usually interpersonal events, and all these moments of choice are showing up throughout the day, and starting the day with the resolution and the commitment to bring love to every one of those moments. And when we start doing that, we are preparing for the afterlife. We're we're making this life, we're bringing love into this life in a way that prepares us to hear love and see love in the afterlife. So it's so there are a number of really important ways of getting ready.
Thank you for mentioning that. And I for our listeners, Matt's done a wonderful job, not only of translating and formulating this book, but there's technique in here, meditative technique. There's a lot of technique, not only for preparing for death, but also getting the most out of physical life, which I thought was really a great addition to the book and makes it really, really valuable. In the time we have left, Matt, I want to take on a big subject. And I have to say, I was very surprised to see this in here. And this is the Akashic Records. And the Akashic Records physically have been known about since Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner. And even before that, they probably were considered a different name. I really believe that some of the ancient cultures, like the dynastic Egyptians, Sumerians, Mayans, and so forth and so on, also had access to this, but they called it something else. In the spirit world, the Akashic Records are a profound way to review life and also before, during, and after a life. Talk a little bit about the integration of that in the spirit world, can you?
Yeah, that's really important. Well, the Akashic Record is essentially the record of everything that's happened in this universe since the Big Bang. And we can study the Akashic Record at any point. We can look at, we can look at the Big Bang. You know, we can almost view it like you'd see a video or a travel log, to actually witness the Big Bang. We can open the Akashic Record to the very first seconds of the universe. But primarily the interest we have as souls who are learning is to use the Akashic Record as a place to discover cause and effect. What happens when you do X? How does that affect everything around you? How does that affect, how does the cause and effect of a particular choice roll out over time? And so one of the things that souls spend a lot of time doing is studying the Akashic Record of their own life. Yes, they've reviewed their life, but they also go back and look at each individual choice. And they won't be doing this during life review, but they do this while they're in their soul group. There's a lot of study of their life and looking at choices they made. But then the thing that's so cool about the Akashic Record is that you can actually make a choice different than what you actually did in life. And then the Akashic Record opens a chapter that you can actually roll out and see how that choice would affect everyone for perhaps even years. You can actually
Wow.
How that life would unfold and how the cause of that new choice would have these far-reaching effects for various people and over time and over different situations. And then when you're finished studying it, you close that chapter and it becomes a null event. In other words, it's just a potential. It's not an event that really happened. Yet you can study literally any choice you made. And this is where the idea of multiple universes come from. Yeah. There aren't multiple universes from Jordan's point of view, like we sometimes hear about in quantum mechanics. There are not, each choice doesn't lead to a bunch of other universes that in which you made a different choice. But in the Akashic Record, you can study that. You can study, if I had done something very different, what would have happened? And we can look at the entire range of events following that. And then we close the book, close the chapter. Those things cease to exist other than just potentiality.
That's amazing.
And so a lot of study is hypothetical. If I had done X instead of Y, what would have happened? And so those are very, very powerful lessons. They're not, again, learned in the life review, but they're learned later when we, have time in our soul group. And then the other thing is we can study the Akashic Record of other people's lives, not our own, but other people's lives and choices they made and how those choices affected things and how things would have been different if they'd made a different choice. And we can, you know, so we don't have to, we're not confined to our own existence. We can actually open the record anywhere, and not just on Earth. We can look at the Akashic Record covers every planet on which we incarnate. I have no idea how many planets there are, but there are that where incarnation happens. But I know there are, you know, many, 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 many planets. And so we can actually go and look at the events on other planets and how things were unfolded there and how cause and effect may have played out differently in those different environments on these different planets.
You're talking about a whole nother program, Matt. I mean, I wanted to get into the whole planetary lifetimes, because this is something that I'm fascinated in, which is the whole UFO alien movement and how, as a soul, you know, we connect with alien souls and live on other planets as different kinds of beings, but we don't have time for that now. That's a whole book, actually. That'd be a killer book. Yeah, the Akashic Records are fascinating, and I'm going to have somebody on the show who has written, from a scientific point of view, what they believe the Akashic Records are. I don't know if you can speak to it as a scientist. Maybe you can analyze it from that, but from a soul level, it's pretty fascinating. This has been amazing, Matt, and I would love to have you back again to talk more about this.
Could I just say one thing?
Oh, please, yeah.
About the souls on other planets. Now, one of the things that's so interesting is that, you know, souls on other planets can opt to incarnate on another planet, one that's different than their usual planet. Mm-hmm. And that happens sometimes because the planet dies or conditions get very difficult on that planet, and the soul may choose to incarnate differently. And souls that come on Earth is, as you may know, is notorious as one of the most difficult places to incarnate. It's not for the faint of heart.
Really?
Soul world. This is a very challenging planet and place. And the human body is very challenging because it's so full of emotions and we're often riven by emotions and intense feelings that sort of drive our behavior in ways that can be extraordinarily painful, problematic. But souls that have been on incarnating on another planet come here are called hybrids. And so they show up here and they get into a lot of trouble, very typically. They have some very difficult lives adjusting to this planet. And sometimes, you know, you can recognize hybrids because they may be kind of ethereal and spiritual and having a hell of a time figuring out how things work here. And being very, very sensitive to the violence and the intense emotions that surround us and are also surge through our bodies. So hybrids often come from places that are much easier to exist and live on, less challenging, sometimes maybe less growth, but also they often show up here kind of unprepared for the intense challenges of this place.
Wow. That's kind of interesting that you say that, because you would think that their guides would say, well, now remember, if you sign up for planet Earth, you're in for this, this, and this. You know, you may have been, you know, your other planet that you came from is not even close to the intensity that you're about to explore. Yeah. I find that fascinating. Does Jordan talk at all about alien or souls that come from other planets and the experience of, say, a planetary system that is a million, half a billion years in advance of us?
Yeah. It's really an interesting question. I don't know much about other planets, and he hasn't said much about it, but I know that he's clear that soul consciousness develops at different rates in different places. Now, but remember, just this one kind of difficult to grasp thing, at least for me, is that on some level, everything is happening at the same time. You know, from the spirit world, you're looking at these planets, and of course they're in different states. You know, from our position, these other planets with these other incarnating souls are in different stages of development. They're you know, some of them are very advanced, some of them may be more primitive, and so forth. So from our limited perspective, at this frozen moment in time, they're in different levels of development. But if you look at it from the spirit world, you can see all of these the developments simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so the entire scope of development on each planet can be seen from the very first sentient being to the last breath of the last incarnating soul on that planet. That entire scope can be seen from the spirit world.
That's amazing. Yeah.
So I'm just.
That's fascinating. The book's called The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife. My guest has been Matthew McKay, Dr. McKay. I urge you to get this book simply because not only is it a fascinating read, but again, it has tools. And I've always said, if you can get tools for transformation of any kind, especially in our internet-packed world, go for it. And this has wonderful tools. Matt, I wish you much success on this book, and I definitely want to have you back because there's so much more that we didn't cover. And this is a topic that I have to just say this. I think you've evolved the whole notion of death beyond just the NED, the near NDE, the near death experience, which doesn't give us a hell of a lot. This gives us a heck of a lot more. And I hope you continue to write and work with Jordan on this topic of what is happening as a soul. So, hey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cliff. I so enjoyed talking to you today.
I'm reminded of the Delphi oracles from ancient Greece and other early civilization, Western-style civilizations, who used the channeling method for regular prophecy, daily activities. And I mean, I've been interested in the channel phenomenon for a long time, and this is a good use of it. And I find it satisfying, but I'd like to see more of it. I'd like to see it develop into a way to communicate with relatives that have passed on or people who want more information from the spirit realm. And a few years ago, there were a number of noted channels. Lazarus was one that I'm aware of. Abraham is another noted channel that is still going strong. You can go to one of their seminars. But that's kind of big tent channeling. I'd like to see it more focused on individuals. So this is a nice introduction into it. And it's also qualifying to have a clinical psychologist validate it. And oh my God, having his own son as the source of that material is fabulous. So another look at the death process. Now, like I mentioned earlier in the show, or in the beginning, I should say, Daniel Brinkley, who had a near-death experience came back to really explain the death process, will be the guest in November, and we'll hear it directly from him. He's written a couple of books, and the most noted one is Saved by the Life, which is an interesting book. And he's traveled the United States and parts of Europe talking about his experience in the afterlife, the etheric place known as where we go after death. So it'll be fun to have him back to talk at length about his experience when he passed over and then came back in a near-death experience. So, wow. Stay tuned for another really excellent show. We have an interview with a scholar who has studied the Immaculate Conception, the miraculous pregnancy of Mary, of Mary Magdala, who is featured in the Bible. Apparently, the process of virgin birth, celibate birth, was carried on in ancient Egypt and other cultures, and she has done some fabulous research on conceiving with elementals, conceiving with divine presence, and it's just fabulous what was created from these interactions. And that's our program next week, the Divine Birth program. And it's fun to present this material. I have not heard about this phenomenon until I read this book. And the guest is a PhD and has studied this intensely and actually believes that this is something that goes on occasionally. And in the past, it actually was a way for us to evolve by bringing in these very high level beings like Jesus Christ. So, and the Buddha and Muhammad and other noted figures perhaps were conceived in this manner. So look forward for that next week. All right, that's it for this edition of Destiny. I want to again thank Dr. Matthew McKay, and as always, our production team consisting of Ruth Thomas and the other unseen individuals who help make Destiny happen. So thanks to everyone, and I hope you have a good week, and we'll talk to you next time.